want to make an expanded comment on the point, because this is really a book like you've never studied before. This is L. Frisky personified, I want to tell you. But really, I think it is a very positive message from God to us. I want to think about that. And I want to struggle with what's this book doing in the canon today. Because I wouldn't have put this book in the canon after reading it. So why did the rabbis put it in? You know, they put it in for a purpose. And they believe it said something about the spiritual relationship as well as the physical. But let's look at this book. As you notice, this book is entitled, in my Bible, it has Song of Solomon. Does anybody here have a translation that has Song of Songs? A few years ago, I read a book by a fellow that's well known, I won't mention his name, but that makes a whole big deal about the structure of the New Testament books. And he made a deal how this, the Gospels were together, meant something in Acts. And did the same thing for the Old Testament. But you do know that the English order of Old Testament books is not the original, don't you? I mean, the Jews didn't do it that way. You know, theirs is totally different. And we can't build a whole lot on a structure that is not original. Now, most ancient Hebrew books get their title from the first two or three words of the book. And that's the title it goes. So the first two or three words of this book are the Songs of Songs. Now, remember when the seraphim around the throne of God called God holy, holy, holy? Well, they're not in a rut. That is the Hebrew superlative. Well, they're trying to say He is the holiest God. Well, Song of Songs is another Hebrew superlative, which means this is the best song that Solomon wrote in this area. This is the definitive work on human love, if you want to put it that way. And so that's where the Hebrews get the title from. We get the word canticles, basically from the Latin Vulgate. And so if you have a Catholic Bible, it's called canticles, and that's where they get that from, is the Latin translation. Now, the authorship is, I don't think there's any doubt at all about the authorship. There has been some. I'm not real, what word should I use? I don't just take what's said at the top of the Bible automatically. I want to look at the internal evidence, because many of the titles are much later in the books, as you know. And I don't believe Solomon wrote Ecclesiastes. After studying it, I don't believe he wrote it. I don't believe Paul wrote Hebrews. But I do think after studying this book that Solomon's the author. And the reason for that is several reasons. Now, by Solomon, I'm talking about the son of David, king over united Israel, the one you know of in the Bible, okay? That's Solomon. Now, there's some internal evidence for that. It's not just traditional authorship. And let me give you, I've listed A through E here. Number one, the mention of Egyptian horses in chapter 1, verse 9, fits very well into Solomon's life. Solomon was the first one to bring horses from Egypt into Palestine. And he did that in 1 Kings 10, 28. So I think that fits well in the life of Solomon and wouldn't fit before that at all. Okay, number two, the rabbis like to have a little maxim here. I've written it for you. The rabbis say when a man is young, he writes love songs. When he becomes an adult, he writes proverbs. And when he gets old, he says all's vain. Well, I don't know if that's true or not, but they use that maxim to say Solomon wrote Song of Songs in his youth, and that does fit because there's not a big harem yet, and there's still some romantic passion in Solomon, which I think with 1,000 wives could not have lasted too long into his career. Number C is the mention of the name Solomon several times specifically, which does not occur in Ecclesiastes, but does occur in this book. And then number D, the word the king, which obviously refers to Solomon. Also, number E is very important. Look at the whole book. This book takes in geographically all of northern Palestine and Syria, all the way down to the Arabah, clear down into the Jordan Rift Valley, plus sites in between. So it seems that this is a united kingdom, very large United Kingdom, which fits David and Solomon only. Okay? So I think that's a real key. Number two under authorship, and this is going to be very helpful in interpreting the book. This is a particular kind of literature called wisdom literature. Now, there are three sources of revelation. There is the law, there is the prophets who react against that, and there's a group of men known as the sages who are gifted by God in talking about daily, practical, nitty-gritty, Monday 9-to-5 life. Song of Songs is that kind of literature. Now, what does that mean? Well, if Song of Songs is much like Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, it's the preparation of the younger generation for life. So it's talking about it to the young. Now, I can't think of no greater subject to talk about godly young than the proper place and attitude and joy of Christian sex. Not as the book does it. So I think it really fits in this practical daily living scheme of things. And so I think that that's what it's talking about. I've written on number two that point. Now, in number two, I want to hit what I think is the literal meaning of the book. And that is, I think literally, without there's no internal evidence to say different, it is the excitement, the joy, and the agony of human love. And the agony is there as well. Now, in canonization, this is one of the megalope, and that's a translation, meaning five rolls. It's a little bitty books that are read at certain of the feast days, okay? Esther is read at Purim. Ecclesiastes is read at one of the feasts. I've offhand forgotten which one it is. I think it's the Feast of Tabernacles. But this one is read at Passover. This little book is read every year, depending on the day that Passover falls on. It's a lunar calendar set. So, it is read at Passover. Number three, this book is, if you've read this book, I hope you have. It probably surprised the hound out of you. It's in the Bible. It surprised me when I read it was in the Bible. The rabbis had the same questions you had. What is this book doing in the Bible? You know. And so they struggle with it some. What is its purpose? And at the end of the day, if you look back at your outline number four, we're going to do theories of interpretation before they tried to handle it. But basically, the Old Testament canon was not completely set in all its form, at least officially, after the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. The Pharisaic party survived. The Sadducean party did not. And the Pharisees moved to a place called Jamnia. And at Jamnia, from A.D. 90 to A.D. 110, many of the codifications of the Talmud, many of the collections of the Targums and all that was done. And a very famous rabbi at this time was named Rabbi Akiba. And he is the one who championed this book and got it fully accepted within Judaism of its day, though it had been read for years at the appropriate place. So it was kind of an affirmation of its canonization. Now, number four, I want to read verbatim, and I want you to think what I'm saying. There's one misprint here, and I'm going to read it correctly so you can change it on yours. Because this book is in the official list of the self-revelation of God, there seems to be a need among many interpreters of the Bible to find more in this book than a simple message of the joy and beauty of human sex. We must remember that God is spoken of analogously in anthropomorphic terms. Add the word terms. God is not a human being, but He is a personal God. And the only way we can describe Him is in terms that we can understand. God often uses the most intimate human interpersonal relationships as metaphors of His relationship to man. Example, husband and wife, parent and child. The New Testament affirms this is the understanding of the church as the bride of Christ. There's another marriage metaphor to describe the relationship between God and the church. That's an example of this. We are speaking analogously, of course, but we are affirming a great truth. Because the book Song of Songs is in our canon, there must be a spiritual analogy to the joy of sexual union and the joy of spiritual union with God. Now, if all you had was the book, there's nothing in the book that would give us a clue to spiritualize it. There's nothing there anywhere except you look down at the very last, next to last sentence on number 7 of theories. Have you read chapter 5, verse 7 lately? Something weird is happening here. Now, this woman, as you know, loses her lover twice, goes searching far in the streets, and the second time she does it, she gets beat up by a watchman. Beat up badly. Well, now this does not fit in a love song. There's something in the plot here that's not normative in a love song. So I think that is one clue in the book that we have something more than just a love song. It's almost like we're reading somebody's mail when they're young, isn't it? Isn't it? It's just like we just opens. I don't know if you ever opened your kid's mail, but they've got some pretty frisky letters they've been sending around. This is something like that, I think. Now, let's go to theories of interpretation, because I think that adds quite a bit to see where other men have tried to see this book. Number one is Jewish allegory. The Jews, in all of their writings, the Mishnah, the Talmud, the Targums, all affirm this book describes God's love for Israel and is a running sequence of the history of the Jews. Now, guess what the early church did? They said the same thing, but they said it's Christ's love for the church. And I've listed some of the big stars in the early church. And look who the guys who made this allegorical interpretation. Jerome of Alexandria, you might expect that from being influenced by Philo. But anyway, Jerome, Athanasius, that's a level-headed boy, Augustine, Thomas Aquinas, Martin Luther, all of these men believe this book was a spiritual allegory of the relationship between God's love for the church through history. Number three, and I think number three explains to us what the form of this book is. Traditional marriage customs. Many have asserted the similarities in the Song of Songs and the Syrian marriage songs known as, and I don't know how to pronounce that, W-A-S-F-S. Wasps, you think? What they would do, they have marriage is a 7-day deal in the Middle East. It is a week festival. And so during this week, the bride would sing a love song to the bridegroom. The bridegroom would sing a love song to the bride. If you've read Song of Songs, at least in any new modern translation, it is broken up into a song the bride sings, the bridegroom sings, then the chorus, the bride sings. It's almost like what we have here. Literary speaking is one of these love songs, traditional love songs. Okay, number four. Some see this as a drama. And there's been several theories. Some see it's a drama between King David and a new, beautiful wife that he really falls in love with. Some see it as a drama with three actors. The king, the beautiful young maiden, but a hometown boyfriend called the shepherd. And Solomon can't woo this woman's love away from that shepherd and finally sends her back home. Now, I don't see that shepherd in there. I think the title shepherd is a beautiful title for the king of Israel. Just another way of describing the king is the word shepherd, because it describes God. I don't see that three play acting. Matter of fact, drama, as we know it in Greek tragedies and Greek plays, is unknown in Israel. Even Job is not a drama. So I think this theory is pretty much off base. Number five. Since the discovery of many Eastern texts in Babylon, the theory of the Song of Songs is really a reworked description of the agricultural god Adonis and Tammuz, which would be the agricultural fertility god, the rising and dying. Now, I think that's horrendous. I don't think it has anything to do with that. That's just somebody who needed his PhD and decided to do a thing on that was different. You know, that's just the pits. Number six. Human love. Now, I want to say I affirm the literal interpretation of this text. I want to say it's all of the theological conservative fiber in me that sex is good, wholesome, a gift from God, wonderful in His bounds, joyful, meant to fulfill man. And I think it is a real affirmation of the literalness of this book that there's nothing dirty or ugly about human sexuality. Now, I want to say that. I want to just stamp it in concrete that sex is good. So I think this is very appropriate. Only periods of history where sex has been looked down on has this book been criticized. And when they say, well, it can't mean this because sex is evil, then they try to do something else. I want to start with saying, literally, I want to affirm this book's place in God's practical wisdom literature. But number two, by the way, the guy who really got, well, he got Acts, the whole council of the early church condemned him for his literal interpretation of this, is a guy whose method of interpretation I follow, and that is Theodore of Mopsuestia. Have you ever heard of him? He's in the same line as Lucian, which is the Antiochian school of the historical grammatical method of interpreting the Bible. You've got two major schools. You've got Alexandria, Egypt, allegory. You've got Antioch of Syria, and that's where Paul and Barnabas sent out from, that major center of Christian learning, developed a more literal, saying the scriptures are literal, take them at face value. What they seem to mean is what they are. Don't spiritualize them away. Well, Theodore of Mopsuestia is a major light in that Antiochian school of the literal interpretation of the Bible, and I affirm that very much. It's my normal way of interpreting. Number seven, and I want to read this again so we can discuss it. Parable. This view tries to take seriously the literal interpretation, but because of the book's location in the canon, it assumes there is a further representation or purpose of God's love through Christ for his people. These last two examples seem to me to combine two necessary elements of our understanding of this book. First, it takes seriously the literary setting of the joy of human sex and the biblical affirmation of monogamy. Yet, it also takes into account that this poem is included in the sacred writings of Israel, which claim to be the self-revelation of God, and because of that, there must be a representative or typological meaning. Another reason I support a possible typological understanding is found in chapter 5, verse 7. I hope you'll look at that. This seems highly unusual in a love song. Also, theory number 3 seems to give a real insight into the literary form of the book. Now, with that as kind of a starting place, if you've read this book, or for me, I'd like to talk to you about, before we get into the text, some insights that you may have. Any comments or questions? Donnie? Okay. Chromorphic. Okay. The Greek word for man is anthropos, okay, is one of them. So it means speaking about something as if it was human. So what we do, and it's really something you need to think about, we put human terms, human emotions, human physical characteristics on a spiritual being, right? God does not have a body. He is spirit. But we say God's hand. God walked. God heard. God repented that he made man. God loves. Well, all of those are humanly analogous to God, but they do not fathom the depth of God's being. We have to talk in terms of humans, but we know when we do, we still haven't captured the fullness of God. I got a neat sermon on that I preached on Mother's Day called The Femininity of God. It's in the library. You might enjoy that. The mothers didn't, but I thought it was terrific. In my Bible, when I'm getting ready for this book, I went through, and if you have New American Standard, and this is not inspired at all, but in the margin it says bride, chorus, and bridegroom. Well, that doesn't show up to my eye because it's too locked in with all those scriptures. So I put over in the margin B, chorus, and BG by these different song groups. And that kind of helps me see what happened. I see two lovers on a stage singing to each other. Now, they're singing to each other as time passes. You know, we're not talking about one day. We're talking about, you know, a long period of time. But they're kind of singing love songs to each other. And I bet husbands, you haven't told your wives that her neck is like the Tower of David in a long time. You know, some of these metaphors are really going to be loose for us. He says your eyes are like pools. You know, your lips are like cherries. Your breath is like wine. Well, he's trying in the metaphors of his day to tell that lady something special about her. Now, it sounds absolutely ridiculous to us, you know, and it gets pretty vivid, but it does not get lewd. It gets expressive, but it does not get pornographic. And it's beautiful. I really think it's wonderful, literally, though I think it is going to have a parabolic, typological expression of if human love is this good, what can the love of God be like? If human union between two fallen, sinful people brings this much joy, this depth of meaning, what can the real union between God and His people, what is that fully going to be like? And that's how I think the analogy flows. But the text itself is a love song. Is a love song. And we'll have to struggle with chapter 5. There are not many good commentaries on this. There really, really aren't. Matter of fact, the ones I have so far, and I ordered 5 more, I hope they get here before I finish the book. The ones I have, I'm not sure I want to recommend. So I don't know where to get any extra insight, except read this in several translations. If you have a commentary at home on the whole Bible, look at it. It'll help you, even if it's not real complete. It'll give you some ideas. I hope more than anything that we can sense the beauty of knowing Jesus. But I also hope that in these few days together, we're not going to embarrass anybody about talking about the beauty of the way God made our bodies and of the excitement we feel in the fulfillment of another human being. You know, when I do a sermon, I always go back to Genesis where it says, God created this good. God created this good. And finally, in chapter 2, it says, everything God created is very good. And one time in all those opening chapters, it says that something is not good. It says it's not good for man to be alone. Here is man in perfect fellowship with God, no sin. They're walking together. They're talking together. And God made us lonely. Think of the implications for that as far as human beings. That means with full, perfect fellowship with God, there is still a longing in us to share something of ourselves with another human being. I think that's staggering in its theological implications. So, let me